From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.
After Andrew Carnegie decided to donate his entire fortune to charity, he felt entitled to exploit his workers by paying them even less and forcing them to work 12-hour days, 7 days a week. His rationale was that the more he squeezed out of his workforce, the more he could give back to the community after he retired. It's one of the tycoon's many contradictions that David Nassau writes about in his new biography called Andrew Carnegie. It's published by Penguin Press, and I'm very pleased to welcome Mr. Nassau back to my show today. Hello.
Delighted to be here.
Last time you were here was to talk about The Chief, the life of William Hearst. Do these two men, both tycoons, have much in common, other than they were both fabulously rich?
Well, the most interesting thing is what they didn't have in common. I went from writing about a guy who was about 6'4" with a squeaky little girl voice to a guy who was probably 4'11" with a deep, wonderful voice. What they had in common, I think, was that they were both visionaries in their own ways. They saw what was coming next in their industries, and then they acted on it.
What about his contemporaries? Is Andrew Carnegie's story more compelling than Andrew Mellon's or J.P. Morgan's or one of the other tycoons of the late 19th century?
Yeah, I think so. I certainly think so. The man had a soul, not always one that you want to bless or you want to celebrate, but he has a soul. He has unbelievable ambitions. He doesn't want to simply be the richest man in the world. He wants to be an intellectual. He wants to be an author. He wants to be known as much for his brains, his intellect, his writings, as for his money.
Now, this is not the first biography of Carnegie. Did you come upon new material?
Yeah. I was really lucky. The last full-scale research biography, fully researched biography, was in 1970 by Joseph Wall. Terrific biography. But I was able to discover some of it through the wonders of the internet, material all over the place, from Wales to Edinburgh to London, all through the United States. And I was able to get all sorts of delightful little materials that were unknown and unavailable. I found his prenuptial agreement. I found his citizenship.
He wrote a
papers.
Prenup?
Yeah. It's in a sense my smoking gun. Everybody thinks that the standard view is that after Homestead, which was a bloody strike in which Frick and Carnegie called in armed thugs wearing Pinkerton uniforms to shoot down workers and stop a strike. Everyone thinks that that was why he gave away his money. But I discovered from finding his prenup that he decided to give away well before Homestead.
So you have discovered a man who's different from the one that we have known in the past. And you begin the book with, we thought we knew him, but we didn't. And that was how he wished it.
Yeah. Andrew Carnegie was a man who invented Andrew Carnegie. And he did so very well. I'll give you one example. He didn't want the world to know that he was a tiny little man. So he was never photographed standing next to anybody else, wore high-heeled boots and hats whenever he was photographed. He didn't want the world to know that he was responsible for calling in the Pinkertons. So he was on vacation in Scotland when the Pinkertons came in and the strike was broken, and then subtly and not so subtly let out the word that it was Frick's idea, not his. And it would have been very different if he was around. It wouldn't have been.
But because of other things that he had said and written, people might have assumed it really was Frick's idea. He might have gotten away with it.
He wrote, when he was in iron manufacturing, he was a good guy. Iron mills were mostly skilled workers, and he knew you couldn't You couldn't beat him. If they walked away from the job, there was nobody to replace him. So when as an iron mill owner, he was terrific. He was well-liked by his workers. He cooperated with the unions. He wrote letters. He wrote articles that all employers should work with unions.
He almost sounded like a socialist. He even called himself a socialist.
Yeah, he sounded very much, and he did not endear himself to any of his fellow capitalists by saying, look, unions are the wave of the future. We've got to work with them. When he went into steel, it was very different. There he had thousands of employees. There he had millions of dollars invested in machinery that he did not want to run idle. And a lot of those workers were unskilled and could be replaced if need be. So when he became a steel employer, he changed his opinion radically and did everything he possibly could to eliminate his steel mills.
Despite all the things he had said to the contrary of the way he was acting.
Yeah.
I mean, was in your research, did you come upon anything where he tries to rationalize?
Well, let me, no. He said,
I mean, he must
very
have been aware
clearly,
of that he was saying one thing and then doing something else.
Yeah, he was very much aware of that, but he said time and time and time again, I am going to pay my workers no less than they're paid anywhere else in the country. Of course, he looked at the lowest wage he could find and, you know, that was what he paid him. And he also said, I can't work with the unions because they're getting in my way. I want to give you guys work. I don't want to be, you know, I don't want Chicago's in a better position now. Pittsburgh once was. Chicago now is because it's closer to the West where they need rails and steel in order to compete with Chicago. Keep your jobs, guys. We got to get rid of the union and we'll work together without them.
My guest is David Nassau, whose latest book is Andrew Carnegie. It is published by the Penguin Press. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Let's go back. Now, here's this guy who comes to the United States when he's 13 years old. Did he try to assimilate or did he try to hold on to something that would identify him as a Scot?
Both. You know, this is why... Only in one of the things I realized when I was writing this book.
You could have called this a study in contradictions.
Yeah, well, one of the things I realized when I was writing this book, and I think I knew it in the Hearst book, but not as clearly, is that you can't resolve all the contradictions. Only bad 19th century melodrama and cartoons resolve the contradictions. You've got to live with those contradictions. You've got to write about them. When it came to being a Scotsman, he quickly got rid of his Scotch accent when he was around people who weren't Scottish. But when he was around people who were Scottish, he held on to it. He was proud to be a Scotsman, but he was also very proud to be an American.
Why did they come here?
They came here because his father could no longer support the family. His father was a linen weaver. He wove fine linen tablecloths and napkins. What happened was that most of those tablecloths and napkins were sold in the United States. In the 1840s, the American government put a tariff which made it impossible to sell those tablecloths. There was no work for linen weavers. Andrew Carnegie's mother understood that the father was defeated, busted, unable to support the family, so she borrowed money and brought the family to the New World.
And she actually is the strongest.
She's the heroine.
One here.
She's the heroine. He absolutely loved, adored, and admired her.
So had he gotten any education in Scotland? Because he's pretty much an autodidact.
Yeah, he spent 2 years in a Lancasterian school. The family couldn't afford to send him to one of the better schools, so he went to a factory school with about 120 students and one teacher.
And when they came here, they went to Allegheny City, Pittsburgh. I mean, outside of Pittsburgh.
Yeah, Allegheny City is now the north side. It's now part of Pittsburgh. Then it was a separate municipality with lots of work. It was already becoming the manufacturing center of the country.
It was called the Sheffield of the West, and also hell with the lid off.
It was probably one of the dirtiest, grimiest, most horrible cities. I mean, the grass wasn't green. It was gray from the soot. which came down over the entire city. It was difficult to breathe. It was difficult to walk. The people with any money moved high into the hills to get away from the smoke and the grime.
So why would they move there, of all places?
They moved there because there was work. And they moved there because Maggie Carnegie, Andrew's mother, had relatives. And they were told that there would be plenty of work.
And was this a good place for someone like Carnegie to move to? Somebody who does want to succeed?
Carnegie said all his life that one of the reasons he became a multimillionaire was that his mother had plopped him down in Allegheny City. He said over and over again that with all his, you know, skills, all his genius, if he had landed anywhere else, he never would have been able to make this money.
But it's also my sense that luck played a major role in all of his success. He couldn't just say, well, it's because I was a genius, I could have made it anywhere.
And he realized that. He realized that. One of the things he did, which I admire, was that he said over and over again, I didn't make this money. I landed in the right place at the right time. I was at the center. If it wasn't for all of these different factors, including the fact that the population and the economy were growing. They needed railroads. Railroads needed steel. And I was in a place that could manufacture steel.
But he didn't begin there. What were his early jobs when he arrived?
He went with his father because he was so little, so tiny, that his mother was frightened. So the two of them went off to work in a cotton mill. The father lasted about 6 weeks, couldn't do it. Andy stayed, Andra, as he was called then. He stayed and he was a bobbin boy, and he quickly graduated. He was smart. He always looked out for mentors. He knew how to ingratiate himself, incredibly charming. And he moved up a couple of steps until he was discovered by a Scotsman who ran the telegraph company, a man by the name of O'Reilly. And he went to work for the telegraph company, and first as a messenger boy, then graduated to being a telegraph operator. When the Pennsylvania Railroad moved across the mountains to Pittsburgh, Tom Scott, who was the division superintendent, needed a bright young boy to be his telegraph operator and his assistant. And Andy Carnegie was the boy chosen for the job.
And he learned a lot from working for the Pennsylvania Railroad. He started investing.
Yeah, he started investing, but without having to put any money down. He was in the middle of what we would today call insider trading, what might land people in jail. These things were not against the law, though frowned on at the time. When the Pennsylvania Railroad decided that it needed to build iron bridges because the wooden bridges were burning down, instead of contracting it out, the president and the vice president, with Andy Carnegie, formed their own company, manufactured the iron bridges for the railroad, and the president gave this company, no one knew that the president was the chief stockholder, the contracts to build these iron bridges. Andy ran the company. He ran a bridge company, then he ran an iron mill that supplied the bridge company with its iron, and he began to pile up money.
But he wanted to be a man of learning. So how did he reconcile this with a life that is all involved with money and profits?
He wanted to get enough money, I think, early on so that he would be comfortable, so that his mother would be comfortable, so that his brother would be comfortable, so that they would never be in the position that they had been in Scotland, where there was literally not enough to eat. And
it's like a depression kid.
Yeah. I think so. No, that's a really good analogy, very good analogy. But what happened was by the time he was 35, he had his millions, and he went into semi-retirement. He left Pittsburgh. He never lived in Pittsburgh during the time his steel mills were built or run. He moved to New York.
But he'd said when he was young that when he was 35, he was going to move to Oxford and get a literary education.
Yeah, isn't that wonderful?
He didn't do that. He moved to New York instead.
Well, but he moved to New York because he wanted to get a literary education in New York.
But he didn't go to Columbia University.
He had better things to do with his time. He joined a number of literary salons. He made friends with the editor of the Century magazine. He joined the most high-powered literary salon in New York, and he started writing and writing and writing and writing, and became a published author by the time he was in his 40s, and kept writing and kept seeking out people like Herbert Spencer. He was a good friend with Mark Twain and learned from them and learned writing by writing.
And I have in my hand a Penguin classic, Andrew Carnegie, The Gospel of Wealth, Essays and Other Writings. So he's still in print.
Oh, he's still in print, and he has written, you know, lots of stuff. He's written an autobiography. He wrote three travelogues, dozens and dozens of essays.
But he stayed in business.
He stayed in business from a distance. He worked about 2 hours a day. He had a genius for choosing the right people, and he had a genius for reading cost sheets. So every week he would get reports from his mills about how much money had been made, what the sales were, what the costs were, what the profits were. And based on those, he would send detailed instructions back to Pittsburgh. But he worked 2 or 3 hours a day, and that was all.
And he kept on getting richer and richer.
He got richer and richer, and he understood that there was, in his life at least, there was an inverse relationship between how hard he worked and how much money he made. He had worked hardest when he was a kid as a bobbin boy and made the littlest amount of money. He made millions when he worked 2 hours a day at home, you know, writing letters and looking over cost sheets.
So let's talk about his politics. He said he believed in the power of the working man. And then, even though he's making all this money and can obviously afford to be a generous boss and plans somewhere down the line to give away all the money, he's not amassing it for his kids or anything. Why are his policies as a businessman so antithetical to the things he was writing about?
Because he had read and absorbed and used Herbert Spencer to give him a rationale to do what he wanted to do anyway. Herbert Spencer said that evolutionary progress is guaranteed, that unlike Darwin, who didn't guarantee progress, Herbert Spencer guaranteed progress. Things were going to get better and better and better. And
growing out of his interest in Darwin.
Yeah, and Spencer said things were going to get better and better and better because in each generation there are a handful of people who understand the way the world is moving. The captains of industrialists were that group. And money was going to go into their hands so that they could then spend it for the greater good of the greater community. And Carnegie believed that all the brains, all the skills that he had used in making his money had to be used in giving it back to the community and spending it.
But in an odd way, he is like a Marxist who believes that you have to go through a rough time before you get to the good time.
Well, that was his experience, and that was his life. But
he's making it rough on an awful lot of
people.
Well,
but and there's a, you know, there are moments in which I like this guy a lot. There are moments in which, you know, I wanted to kick him across the table or across the room. There's one moment in which he goes back to Pittsburgh to dedicate one of his libraries, and he says, "I'm often asked why, instead of giving you libraries, I don't raise your wages." And he said, "I'll tell you why. If I raised your wages, you'd spend that money on drink, on better cuts of meat, and on clothing." And he said, "That's not what you need. You don't need things of the body. You need things of the spirit, and you wouldn't pay for them yourselves. So I'm taking this money out of your paycheck and giving you concert halls, libraries, schools, museums, art galleries."
So he was paternalistic
in the extreme.
And he sees himself as an industrialist era philosopher king.
He sees himself as a philosopher king. He sees himself as someone who is going to make the world better. He sees himself as someone who has to make really tough decisions to make the world better. And people are going to be sacrificed.
My guest is David Nassau, the author of the bestseller, The Chief, The Life of William Randolph Hearst, which won the Bancroft Prize and the J. Anthony Lucas Prize, the Ambassador Book Award, was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award for Biography. Also, Going Out, The Rise and Fall of Public Amusements, and Children of the City, At Work and at Play. He is a distinguished professor of history at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. And his latest book is Andrew Carnegie. It's published by the Penguin Press, and we will continue our conversation after this. We're back with David Nassau, N-A-S-A-W, his latest book, a biography of Andrew Carnegie, called Andrew Carnegie, and published by the Penguin Press. And it's important to say Carnegie, not Carnegie.
You know, I commend you. This is the first interview I have had where we didn't have to begin with a pronunciation lesson.
Now, did he insist?
His family now insists, and the Carnegie Corporation insists, and the people of Pittsburgh insist. When I was in Pittsburgh about a week ago, I was, you know, assailed by a Pittsburgher who says, "How come you New Yorkers think you have the right to say it wrong?"
Because we have Carnegie Hall.
Well, Carnegie Hall is the correct pronunciation, and the Carnegie Deli is the correct. But when you get beyond the hall and the deli, you got to say Carnegie, because he's a Scotsman, and he pronounced his name, and his nickname was Naig, N-A-I-G.
Now, why don't we call it Carnegie? I always call it Carnegie Hall, and New Yorkers correct me. I figure if you're going to say Carnegie, he did give the money for that, didn't he?
He, you know, it was his only, one of his few failures as a businessman. He didn't want to give the money for the hall. He thought New Yorkers had enough money. Pittsburgh, he'd give him a hall. Dunfermline, he'd give him a hall. But New York, no. The reality was that there was no real symphony hall in the 1880s. There were all the piano companies. Steinway and Chickering had their own little halls. The Metropolitan Opera was a disaster for symphonies. So he was persuaded by a bunch of friends of his to build a hall. He said he'd only do it as a joint stock company. He'd lend them money, and he wanted a return. And that's why Carnegie Hall, or Carnegie Hall, was built with a lot of rooms on top that could be rented out.
I always wondered about those rooms.
But it never worked. It never worked. And they kept coming back to him and saying, you know, we need another loan. We need more money. And he'd reluctantly give it to him.
Now, he had to work with all of the major capitalists of his time. And yet, he was professing very different ideas. Whether he was living them is another matter. Did they just see him as eccentric, or, well, okay, that's what Andrew does, but in the end we can make this deal and make a lot more money for everybody?
He was, you know, there's one great moment, I talk about it in the book, in which Rockefeller has bought all the iron ore in the Mesabi. He's got all the land, acres and acres and miles of land, and Carnegie needs it to continue to produce steel. So the two men delegate their underlings to work out a deal. It doesn't go anywhere, and Carnegie writes to Rockefeller and he says, look, this is nonsense. Let's you and I sit down and get it done. And he says how it would get done, and the deal is reached. He was an incredible businessman, and they were scared. Everyone was scared of him. One of the reasons why J.P. Morgan bought him out in the end in 1901 and created U.S. Steel was he was worried that nobody could compete with Carnegie, and unless he was bought out, he was going to be a menace for the last 20 years of his life.
And when he bought him out, Carnegie became the richest man in the world.
Yeah, he said to Carnegie, you are now the richest man in the world. And when you look at the size of the economy then, the $226 million as a percentage of the size of the economy is equivalent to about $120 billion today, which is one-third more than Gates and Buffett have combined. So he had a ton of money when he sold Carnegie Steel to Mr. Morgan.
What did he do at that point? He didn't have to work at all.
Well, he had been in semi-retirement already for 25 years, and he determined at that moment he was going to spend full time. He said, I'm now entered the distribution phase of my life. He was going to give away all his money, but give it away scientifically. Give it away. He wasn't going to give handouts. He was going to find the best ways to give it away. And he said during the last 20 years of his life that giving away money wisely was much more difficult for him than making it. The greatest tragedy in his life was that by the time he approached 80, he suddenly realized that because of compound interest, his money was making so much money that he was going to fail to give it all away during his life.
And what a problem.
It was a terrible problem. His friend and advisor, Elihu Root, said, don't worry, we'll set up the Carnegie Corporation. What's ever left over, we'll go there.
What about the other capitalists? Did they believe in social responsibility?
No.
In the same way that he did?
No. I think it took about 120 years before Warren Buffett and Bill Gates are now saying almost the using almost the exact same words. When Buffett talked about giving back his wealth to the community, he quoted Andrew Carnegie. During the time, nobody paid him much attention. Rockefeller gave away money, but as a Christian, as a, you know, a tithe, he gave away 10%.
And Henry Frick gave us a great museum, the Frick Collection.
Frick gave away Morgan, Mellon. They all gave away money, but no one ever tried to give away all of it, as Carnegie said you had to do.
How did he wind up partnering with Henry Frick, who does not seem like a good match?
It was not a good match. It was a very unstable relationship for a long, long time. But Frick was a genius accountant, a genius businessman, a hard bargainer. Carnegie knew that he couldn't handle men. I think he thought he was going to be too soft, which is why he left Pittsburgh to go to New York and hired men like Frick to deal with the unions and deal with the working men. He wanted Frick to admire him. He wanted Frick to love him. Frick wanted nothing to do with that. Frick worked for him, and at a certain point, Frick expected to take over the business 10 years before Carnegie was ready to give it away. The tensions between the two were always high.
Well, this is a repeat of what had happened when Carnegie was young. He worked for somebody, then achieved a high position in the company and eventually wound up using it to go ahead. I would have thought he would have recognized the same in Frick.
He did recognize it, and he saw what was going on, but he thought that Frick would admire him enough and believe in him enough that Frick would want to work with him as long as he wanted to work with Frick.
Well, he then blamed Frick for what happened at Homestead in 1892. First of all, you should tell us what happened, and then what effect did his blaming it on Frick have on their relationship?
What happened at Homestead was in 1892 was the bloodiest labor conflict in American history to that time, and it's still in all the textbooks. The workers, Frick and Carnegie, said that the only workers who they would keep employed were those who agreed in writing to take a cut in wages, to work extra hours, 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, and sign a pledge that they would never join a union. And if they were members of a union, they would leave immediately.
Sounds like the sort of thing we're hearing today, maybe a little less draconian, but more and more companies are taking away health benefits and other things, for different reasons?
Yeah, well, he said, this is what I need from you, to the workers.
Why? He had more money than anybody could ever want.
But he wanted even more, because the more money he made, and again, he rationalized this. It made sense to him. The more money he could get out of those steel mills, the more money he could return to the community at a later date.
With libraries and colleges.
Yeah,
and
plus the lower the cost of producing steel, the more people he would be able to employ in Pittsburgh, albeit at starvation wages. When the workers refused and began to take over the town to keep out scabs, to keep out substitute workers, Carnegie and Frick called in Pinkertons to take over the town, take control of the water, take control of all the entrances to the town so that they could march in substitute workers.
And what effect did this have on Carnegie's public reputation?
Carnegie and Frick suffered terribly. Frick recovered, his reputation recovered, because he was shot by an anarchist and he became a victim of terrorism, and people quickly forgot what he had done to bring on the strike. Carnegie went into exile for about 2 years, didn't speak out, spent most of his time in Europe, and then came back and quickly tried to rebuild his reputation as a wise man, as an author, as a smart man, and as a benefactor of humanity.
And as an anti-imperialist. My guest is David Nassau, whose book, his biography, Andrew Carnegie, is published by the Penguin Press. In 1898, he comes out as an ardent anti-imperialist in a time when America is going through one of its most important imperialist phases.
He breaks with the Republican Party, that he was the largest contributor to the Republicans and Mr. Republican. He breaks with his party. He opposes American annexation of the Philippine Islands. And in one of those contradictions that no one will ever resolve, nor should try to, he becomes the major opponent of an American Navy. He's against navies everywhere at the same time that his companies are making millions of dollars supplying steel plates for battleships, as armor for battleships. He says, and he writes, and he says again, and he writes again, that if you give two men guns and they get into an argument, they're going to shoot each other. If you give two nations navies and they get into a fight, they're going to go to war.
But he doesn't write about the contradiction of selling all of the steel to be used as ships and as guns.
In the beginning, he says, it's very strange watching him maneuver around this. In the beginning, he says, I'm only selling it for battleships as defensive. You know, I'm not making guns. Then he tries to get into the gun business. And all the time, he's telling himself, we can make this money. Better that I make the money because I'm going to give it back than that Bethlehem Steel makes it.
Did he have the ear of Teddy Roosevelt?
He and Teddy Roosevelt had as bizarre a relationship as he did with Frick, perhaps even more bizarre. Teddy Roosevelt had no choice but to listen to him because he was Mr. Republican and a huge, huge donor and contributor to the Republican cause. But he wanted Roosevelt to be his Frick in foreign policy, and he wanted to be the senior advisor. Roosevelt was his own man, and the last thing he wanted was this silly little Scotsman telling him what to do.
Especially since he was telling him he had an anti-imperialist message, and Roosevelt was saying, speak softly but carry a big stick.
Right. He was saying over and over again, and he tried to convince Roosevelt to be the pioneer, the advocate, the crusader for a League of Peace, in which all the nations of the world would sign agreements saying that they would never go to war, that they would peaceably arbitrate their differences at the Peace Palace in The Hague, which Carnegie had built. At one point, Carnegie spent thousands and hundreds of thousands of dollars paying for Roosevelt's safari to Africa so that Roosevelt, on his return, would be Carnegie's diplomat, Carnegie's messenger, to Germany and to England to get a peace treaty.
What was Carnegie's relationship with Woodrow Wilson like, especially in the lead-up to our involvement in World War I?
His relationship was not a strong one.
Because a Republican and Wilson was a Democrat?
But more than that, when World War I broke out, Carnegie, who had spent all his life campaigning for reason, for justice, for rationality in world affairs, could not believe that the nations of the earth, the nations of Europe, had put themselves into a position where they were going to sacrifice an entire generation of young men. And when the war broke out and when it became clear that the war would only end when a generation was bled white, Carnegie gave up. He lapsed into silence. And from 1915 to 1919, he stopped talking, he stopped writing, he stopped communicating with his friends, with his wife, with his daughter, and with Woodrow Wilson. Up to that point, he had been, you know, in communication with every president of the United States, from Grant to Wilson, telling him what to do.
Had he also lost a sense of Britishness because the British were already in World War I?
He had been an opponent of British imperialism as strongly. I mean, he was against the British involvement in the Boer War. He was against British rearmament and spent as much time campaigning for disarmament and peace treaties in Britain as he did in the United States. He was totally defeated by the reality of war in the end.
Why do you think he was a pacifist?
Because he had read Herbert Spencer.
Rationale for many of his ideas?
He couldn't believe that, I mean, this was the 19th century and the 20th century. He couldn't believe that human beings would slaughter one another as they had in the Dark Ages. Herbert Spencer said things are getting better and better and better and better. There is evolutionary progress. And because of that, he was going to help it along and make sure there was no war.
And obviously he was right, because the 20th century was the most peaceful century in the history of the world. How old was Carnegie when he died?
He died just short. He died in his 80s. But he spent the last 4 years of his life in silence, not writing, not communicating.
But he was still creating all of these, the libraries, and not just Pittsburgh, but places all over the country.
Those had been created prior to 1915. His wife took over the family business of giving away money, and he had fortunately set up the Carnegie Corporation earlier. It was supposed to take effect after his death, but in those years that he lapsed into this silence, into this inactivity, his secretary, his treasurer, and his wife continued to do the work that he had set up for them to do.
David Nassau's biography, Andrew Carnegie, is published by the Penguin Press. And congratulations. The reviews have been fabulous.
Thank you so much.
I thank you so much for being with us again. The book has a picture of Andrew, lots of pictures, but the one on the cover, it's quite clear that this guy was very short.
Thank you. That's why we chose it.
On tomorrow's show, the founder of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting assesses the three major cable news channels, Fox, CNN, and MSNBC. He says they pass over real stories too often in favor of sensationalism. Plus, how to pick the perfect drink for any meal, also an anthology of Jewish vaudeville minstrel songs, and how Watergate forever changed the lives of Carl Bernstein and Bob Woodward. By the way, you can check out some of Ruth Reichel's favorite Thanksgiving recipes, including some from our listeners, at WNYC.org. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Melissa Egan with Sarah English, Brenna Farrell, and Blake Neshek. We had help today from Sam Howard, Fran Jacobs, and Scott Goldberg. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. I'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to The Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.